Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulibi. You can, as always, subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, Woody Allen talks about his latest film, You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger, and his cinematic compulsion to speculate about the meaning of life. Then Bob Mondello looks at quite another film, Buried. It's the latest to explore a claustrophobic subgenre made famous by Alfred Hitchcock. And the Lizard of Wall Street, Gordon Gekko, returns to the screen in Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. But first,
Michelle Norris embarks this week on that great American pilgrimage known as the Book Tour. She'll be traveling the country, talking about her new memoir, The Grace of Silence. That's why David Green is here. Well, before Michelle went, she left us this story about her father, a bullet, and Orson Welles.
My father was a postal worker who always had a thing for Orson Welles. Belvin Norris Jr. was a man who wore fedoras well after the fashion passed. He had a special affinity for movies like Citizen Kane and The Third Man. And if the local stations were re-airing an old Welles radio drama, he'd carry the shoebox-sized Panasonic radio into the living room and sit and listen from his favorite armchair. This year, I realized that as a much younger man, my father probably developed a certain respect for Orson Welles while listening to some of his radio commentaries about a real-life drama. In 1946, Welles launched a blistering radio crusade about the blinding of a black veteran named Isaac Woodard. On the night of February 13, 1946, Woodard was beaten and blinded by police officers in Batesburg, South Carolina. It was only hours after he was honorably discharged from the U.S. Army. Woodard was 27, and he explained in a sworn affidavit that he was still wearing his uniform when he was struck several times in the eye with a billy club. The story, the subsequent trial, and the swift acquittal of the officers caused a national sensation. Welles was among those outraged. The Woodard case had a direct impact on President Harry Truman's decision to integrate the military, and it likely sent an uncomfortable jolt through my father's boyhood home in Birmingham, Alabama. Here's why. 6 days before Woodard was blinded, my father was shot in the leg by police officers in Birmingham shortly after he returned from war. He'd served in the Navy, and he returned to a city full of black veterans who had fought for democracy overseas and were eager to get a taste of it on their home turf. What they faced instead was a wall of white resistance. Their uniforms gave them a new sense of pride, but they still faced old rules about segregation and carefully defined roles. My father's injury was minor. His leg was grazed by the bullet. He was probably still nursing that wound when he listened to Welles' screeds about the Woodard case. But I did not even know until recently that my father was shot. He never talked about it. He moved from Birmingham to Boston and eventually to Minnesota, and he left the story behind like an old, worn-out suitcase. I guess you could say he chose not to bring that baggage into his marriage because he never even told my mother. She, too, only learned about this story recently. Last year, I set out to write a book about America's hidden conversation about race. However, I changed course after listening to the hidden conversation in my own family. I discovered that my parents withheld profound secrets because they didn't want to gunk up the engine of upward mobility. They wanted their children to soar, so they chose not to weigh down their pockets with personal tales of woe. That's why I decided to call my book, my accidental family memoir, The Grace of Silence. But I'm hoping that it will encourage readers and listeners to break past the silence in their own families. History is made in all kinds of little ways. A hiring decision, a school bus ride, a decision to sit at a lunch counter, a simple act of moving forward when someone or something monumental tries to block your path. I bet that some of the elders who sit at your family table might be sitting on stories of their own. Those stories, those individual histories, are so easily lost if we're not willing to exercise the grace of silence in another form, to listen to those who might be willing to share their legacy if only someone is willing to take the time to ask.
That, of course, is our own Michelle Norris. Her memoir is called The Grace of Silence.
When Oliver Stone made his 1987 movie Wall Street, people did not automatically assume there would be a sequel. Maybe we should have. Wall Street didn't become any less dramatic. In a moment, we'll have a review of Oliver Stone's new Wall Street movie. We begin with the links between the movie's great trader Gordon Gekko and real life. Here's NPR's Elizabeth Blair.
Even Gordon Gekko's iconic speech,
"Greed, for lack of a better word, is good,"
was inspired by a real speech given by a real Wall Street powerhouse. In 1986, Ivan Boesky, the arbitrageur who was convicted of insider trading, told a group of college students that greed is all right and greed is healthy.
I was really startled, I think, because he starts giving his famous speech in the first one, and you know that wasn't even fiction.
James Stewart is the author of Den of Thieves, a book about the men behind the insider trading scandal of the 1980s, some of whom inspired the Gordon Gekko character. Stewart says Gekko, as played by Michael Douglas, even resembled Ivan Boesky.
He had the look, he had the suit, the constant suntan.
And like Gekko, Ivan Boesky went to jail for insider trading. In the sequel to Wall Street, Gordon Gekko has served his time, and now he's pretty much broke. Instead of a limo, he's got a MetroCard. He rents instead of owns, and he's estranged from his daughter. Oliver Stone directed Wall Street 1 and 2.
He has no relationships when he comes out of prison. She doesn't come and visit him. It's a very depressing thing. He has no wife. She's left him years ago. His son has unfortunately committed suicide. So he's got nobody who's waiting for him outside the prison. That's after a six-year stretch. That's quite something.
They took my life. And when I got out, who's waiting for me? Nobody!
This resonates with the Boesky story.
Author James Stewart.
Certainly at one time, Boesky was estranged from everyone in his family. His wife left him. His children were estranged from him.
Gordon Gekko is also partly inspired by Michael Milken, known as the Junk Bond King. Milken served less than 2 years in prison. Today, he's a philanthropist. And here's where Gordon Gekko's kinship with these men ends. Boesky and Milken were barred from ever working in securities again. Gekko? Nah, this is Hollywood. He's back in the game.
Right now, it is ugly times ugly. And that's when the ugly get going. You tell him for me, babe, Gordon Gekko is back.
The new movie is set in 2008, just as the magnitude of the financial crisis is being made public. In real life, it was September of that year that screenwriter Alan Loeb, a self-described financial junkie, went to New York to do research for the movie.
You know, September 15th was D-Day in the financial crisis. It was Lehman Brothers. It was the credit crunch getting to this nexus. It was a very, very scary time.
And Loeb was there to talk with bankers and hedge fund managers as research for the screenplay.
It was crazy. I was researching the movie, but I was also watching people come to Jesus. There was a lot of therapy in those sessions. Believe it or not, I'd sit down with people and they would start pouring their hearts out to me. And I'd be like, dude, I'm just writing a movie here.
Alan Loeb says most of the people he interviewed at the time said the worst is behind us. And that miscalculation helped inform Gekko's character. Loeb says he wanted Gekko to be the one in the movie who saw the carnage that was coming.
There were very few people that were saying this is going to get much worse and this is systemic and this is dangerous. And I said, I want Gordon to be one of those guys. And then I want people to laugh at him for it. And then I want him to be right.
You know, there's fortunes to be made. Hundreds of millions of dollars betting against this bubble. Just wish I had a million.
Kind of morphs from the Ivan Boesky character into like one of these big hedge fund guys who bet on the market collapse.
Longtime financial journalist James Stewart wishes the filmmakers hadn't let a convicted felon like Gekko be the one to predict the crash. And yet, Stewart admits, it's not such a stretch. He says Gekko is like a lot of people on Wall Street. He's smart and he loves the game, just not the rules.
One of the messages of the Boesky / Gekko character is that when you're talking about trading, when you're talking about business, you're talking about Wall Street, you know, morality kind of just gets in the way. You know, the goal is to win, the goal is to make money, and as a result, they are completely disdainful of any kind of laws or restrictions or boundaries.
Idealism, says Gordon Gekko, gets in the way of every deal. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Let's invest a couple more minutes in this movie, find out if it's blue chip or toxic. Here's our financial advisor, Kenneth Turan.
Greed may be good, as Gordon Gekko insisted, but evil pays the bills. And the best parts of this erratic and downright messy film are the moments when the bad people take center stage. So let's hear it for fearless 94-year-old Eli Wallach, who makes eccentric chirping noises and reminisces about the crash of 1929. And some applause for Josh Brolin, an arrogant investment banker with an ego the size of Antarctica. He's always looking for new hotshot traders to add to his team.
The mentor-protege relationship is not emotional over anything. And I thought you might be a good addition to the Churchill Schwartz team. Am I mistaken?
Let me tell you something, Brendan. You're not my mentor. So you may talk about moral hazard. You are the moral hazard. You are the worst kind of toxic debt the system is polluted with.
Jake Moore, played by Shia LaBeouf, is more of a striving pipsqueak than a presence to be respected. His weakness is a black hole that sucks energy out of the movie. Sadly, he's also dating Gecko's estranged daughter, and the great man wants to use it to get back in his child's good graces. Gecko looks grizzled as well as charismatic, like a street person turned nightclub impresario. Now that he's out of prison, he attempts to reinvent himself as a celebrity writer and all-around prophet of fiscal doom. This version of Wall Street can't seem to decide if Gecko is the bat-to-the-bone lizard king he once was or someone who's seen the light, thank you very much, and is on the road to redemption. Or maybe he's both. Only one thing is sure. Without him, Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, would be even more of a snooze than it already is.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. If you'd like some help in choosing a movie this weekend, you can find more reviews at our website, npr.org. The latest movie by Woody Allen begins with a silver-haired woman who's been abandoned by her husband in London. She goes for solace to sit across the table from a fortune teller, a woman who offers a glass of scotch and a vision of hope.
You're bathed in a rose light, my darling. You've got nothing but good coming to you, I promise you.
Well, 40 years of marriage is a long time. One becomes terribly dependent. My husband walked out on me for one simple reason. I was too honest with him. I refuse to allow him to delude himself.
The husband, played by Anthony Hopkins, runs off and marries a much younger woman. That story comes from a writer and director who in real life famously left his longtime partner Mia Farrow and married Farrow's adopted daughter. Woody Allen's latest creation is called You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. So who is Alfie, this man played by Anthony Hopkins?
Who is he? He's just a guy who, stated in the film, wakes up in the middle of the night and is laying there, as we all do every once in a while, in the black of the night at 3-4 in the morning. And we start to imagine our own mortality and the meaninglessness of life. And it scared him. He was not ready to pack it in. He still wanted to live. And embarks on a life that becomes catastrophic.
You described just now that moment of reality in the middle of the night so vividly that I couldn't help but start wondering how you slept last night.
I sleep fitfully, but I've experienced that moment. You know, I have moments of waking up in the middle of the night and questioning exactly what the purpose of life was, and it certainly has always frightened me.
So this character you write about, Anthony Hopkins, he runs away from his wife, he proposes marriage to a call girl and then brings her to meet his adult daughter and son-in-law, played by Naomi Watts and Josh Brolin. Afterward, they talk about that meeting, and here they are.
I found that whole public display completely disgusting. And did you see the ring he got her? I'm telling you, she'll take him for everything he's worth and then leave him pouring his heart out to some barman.
Oh, he's a big boy. She'll put a charge in his battery. Maybe she'll give him that son he always wanted.
How infuriating will it be if he has his second family before I have my first?
Where do these characters come from for you as a writer? Are they you? Are they someone that you relate to?
I make them up. I can find traits sometimes in people that I meet or newspaper stories I read, or sometimes I just fabricate them from scratch completely. That's what you do. People always think that writing is based on characters you've observed or autobiographical things, that because it's hard for them to really empathize with an act of imagination. But the author is sitting in an empty room and making up the story completely.
You're not working out some obsession of yours here?
I'm sure I'm working out some obsession without knowing it. I'm not consciously. Consciously, I'm trying to entertain and hopefully make some kind of statement about life or call attention to something or, you know, to do something and not just fill time for an hour and a half.
Well, here's one of the reasons that I ask about your obsessions. When people watch your movies and reviewers write about them, in more recent years, when you've less and less often appeared in them as an actor, people will try to identify who they think the Woody Allen character is. Is there a Woody Allen character in your movies?
Sometimes there are characters in my movies that I would have played if I was younger. I mean, if I was Josh Brolin's age, I might have played his character, married to Naomi Watts and coveting the beautiful next-door neighbor and trying hard to be a writer. I couldn't play it as well as Josh. If I played it, I would play it much funnier and much broader. But that's the character that I would have played. And very often in my films, there is a character that I no longer can play because I'm too old, that I would have played years ago.
There are some reviewers who've watched this movie and thought that Josh Brolin is the character that Woody Allen might have played once upon a time, and there are some reviewers who have thought that Anthony Hopkins, the actor who is about your age and playing an older man who leaves his family, that's the Woody Allen character.
I could conceivably play that, but the difference is, if you can get Anthony Hopkins or you can get me, I want Anthony Hopkins. I mean, you know, it's a blessing to get an actor of that quality to play it. I could have played the character, but I could never have played it in my wildest dreams like Anthony Hopkins plays it.
Well, you've got Anthony Hopkins then speaking these lines that you wrote that you as an actor could have delivered, but delivering them differently than you would. Did you hear those lines in your head as you wrote them, and did you have to get used to them being delivered in a different way when Hopkins took over the role?
Yes, I do hear them in my head when I'm writing them. But when an American author hears a British actor do his dialogue, it suddenly gets catapulted into a more artistic realm. This happened to me when I did Match Point and I first heard Jonathan Rhys Meyers read my lines. All of a sudden, it sounded like I could write, you know? I think, my God, did I write that?
Well, that's interesting because in some ways you could have imagined this story taking place with only a few changes in New York City instead of London. And New York used to be always a character or even almost the leading character in your films. But it sounds like you're feeling comfortable in more recent years as you've moved to other locations.
Well, I do feel comfortable, but I'd like to shoot in New York. You know, I live in New York and I love it. And the places I've filmed at are places that are not that different than New York in a certain sense. I've filmed in Paris, Barcelona, London a number of times. These are all highly cosmopolitan, sophisticated cities. I couldn't, the way some directors do, go out, you know, in the desert and make Lawrence of Arabia for 2 years and live in that kind of atmosphere, or go out to farmland in the United States.
I'm just dwelling for a moment on that possibility you raised of a Woody Allen, Lawrence of Arabia kind of desert epic of some kind and what that
yes,
might be
that,
like.
Directors like that. They go away and they pick these exotic, far-off places. I can't do that. I don't have that kind of dedication to my art. You know, if I get an idea for a brilliant film in the Sudan, I crumple it up and throw it in a waste paper basket and, you know, take a lesser idea that's on 42nd Street.
Woody Allen's new film is called You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The movie Buried arrives in theaters today, and it takes place on what may be the smallest movie set ever created. Actor Ryan Reynolds spends the entire film trapped in a coffin. And that got Bob Mondello thinking about this decades-old phenomenon of the big screen going small.
Film technology has advanced to the point where a movie can do more or less anything. Plunge us into Leonardo DiCaprio's dreams, take us mountain climbing with vampires, rocket us to a moon called Pandora. So what possesses filmmakers to set entire films in tight, defiantly uncinematic spaces? Director Rodrigo Cortez is making a choice in Buried when he puts us, along with actor Ryan Reynolds, in a box, 6 feet by 3 feet by 18 inches.
I'm buried in a coffin in the ground, and I need help. Please send help, I'm begging you.
How did you end up in the coffin, sir?
I was put here.
Ryan Reynolds is hardly the only actor who's suffered this movie fate. Characters were buried alive in the Belgian thriller The Vanishing, in the Coen brothers' Blood Simple, in the gangster movie Casino, and most memorably, perhaps, in Kill Bill 2, where Quentin Tarantino stuffed a battered Uma Thurman into a casket and nailed it shut. But Thurman only spent a few minutes there in a movie that otherwise let her demolish half the Wild West and a good chunk of the inscrutable East. And those other scenes I mentioned were also just scenes. The pictures they were in gave you broad vistas, streetscapes, open air. Buried belongs to a different subgenre, movies where the director decides to ratchet up the tension by trapping the audience in a tight space along with the actors. Think 12 Angry Men, where you're confined to a jury room.
You know, we can be here all night.
Or Das Boot, the German sub-movie where you're so deep underwater the gauges are exploding. Or Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat, where getting rescued in wartime comes with a catch.
It'd be a good idea to get out of here.
Hitchcock loved to narrow the camera's focus and did it over and over after Lifeboat, to a motel in Psycho, an apartment in Rear Window, knowing that holding the audience hostage could make a taut situation downright claustrophobic.
We're all sort of fellow travelers in a mighty small boat on a mighty big ocean. And the more we quarrel and criticize and misunderstand each other, the bigger the ocean gets and the smaller the boat.
The boat's too small right now for me and this German.
Of course, there is that mighty big ocean to make the film feel expansive because, after all, the big screen's great gift is for being big. A stage play is stuck on a set, a painting has a frame, but films capture the imagination because with close-ups, they can be bigger than life, as big, in fact, as all outdoors. But there are reasons to go the other way. Restrict your action to a single room and you lower your budget. Restrict it still further and you start to play with cinematic form, especially in how it affects content. When the Israeli film Lebanon opened this summer, much of its fascination came from the fact that it was a war movie set entirely inside a tank. The audience saw things only as the tank crew did, through the crosshairs of a gun sight. Nice metaphor for how conflict can lead to tunnel vision. The movie Buried also takes place in a war zone and also invites a kind of tunnel vision, not philosophical this time, but cinematic. No question, it's a gimmick so restrictive that you figure the shoot must have been hell. Imagine the director looking for a fresh camera angle in his 6x3x1.5 foot space. The temptation to open things up must have been intense, and it would have been so easy to show the ringing phones the trapped guy is frantically calling on his cell, or cut away to people walking right past his shallow grave. But as with Lebanon and Das Boot and 12 Angry Men, films that put aside Hollywood conventions to think outside the box, there is never a shot outside the box. Because if your point is to keep things tight, you have to have the courage of your restrictions. I'm Bob Mondello.
Tonight, the Metropolitan Opera in New York kicks off its season with Das Rheingold. The first installment of a new $16 million ring cycle features opera superstars Bryn Terfel and Stephanie Blythe. One of the pivotal roles in Wagner's opera, the troll Alberic, will be played by American bass baritone Eric Owens. Reporter Jeff London says Owens may not be a household name, but he's one of the most sought-after singers in the business.
The first thing you notice is the voice. Deep, rich, resonant. But then there's the eclectic repertoire. It seems these days Eric Owens is showing up everywhere, from major opera houses to symphony halls, singing a dizzying array of music, well-known classical works like the Mozart Requiem, freshly minted operas like Grendel, The 40-year-old singer says he doesn't want to be pigeonholed.
I really enjoy just the variety of things that I do, and it's weird. I mean, it can be a good thing, it can be a bad thing career-wise, because I'm not necessarily known for one particular thing. But at the end of the day, I mean, I need to do what makes me happy.
And by doing what makes him happy, Owens makes his collaborators happy, like New York Philharmonic music director Alan Gilbert.
Forget about singers. If you talk about all musicians, there are very few people who are as well-schooled and as widely talented as Eric. He's really someone who, I think, goes to the heart of the matter, and he comes not only prepared, but really understanding the music.
Music has been Eric Owens' passion since grade school. He grew up in Philadelphia, where he still lives, and was already playing oboe professionally in high school. But it was also in high school where he found he could sing. Really sing.
This may sound funny, but I saw more career potential in singing than being an oboe player. As competitive as the opera world is, there's always a job to be had somewhere.
Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Adams thinks that background as an instrumentalist is part of what makes Owens such a superlative musician.
He's got this special past where he really knows what it means to be in an orchestra, to count, to listen for pitch, all the kind of disciplines that come with instrumental playing and ensemble playing. His fundamentals, his musical chops, as we call it, are so secure.
I've been preoccupied with many matters, but the prospect of fallout has not been high on my priority list.
Adams was so impressed with Owens' chops, he created roles specifically for him in two operas. The first was General Leslie Groves, the military head of the Manhattan Project in Dr. Atomic, a look at the birth of the atom bomb.
Eric really wonderfully embodied that role.
What a duel, a Hearst propagandist!
Adams also wrote the role of the storyteller for Owens in A Flowering Tree, an adaptation of a South Indian fairy tale about a girl who can transform herself into a tree.
Children, I want to tell you a story. A story of love and then pain.
Owen says he's relished collaborating with John Adams.
He would send some drafts and say, okay, is this comfortable? Is this too high, too low, blah, blah, blah. You know, and he would rewrite things. So that's really exciting, knowing that you have sort of an effect on the outcome of this wonderful piece of music and that you put your little two cents in there.
Owens says he spends 8 or 9 months on the road, and New York is a frequent destination. Last season, he garnered rave reviews when, in a two-week period, Owens performed the Beethoven Missa Solemnis and a staged concert of George Ligeti's atonal opera, Le Grand Macabre, with the New York Philharmonic. Owens was pitch perfect in the role of Death, even if he admits that finding the pitches was hard work.
in places where it's seemingly atonal, I mean, the way I go about it is you have to sort of create these little blocks of tonality within the atonality. You have to create melodies where it's seemingly just noise. The table, fill up
my head again. Owens is now focused on his very first role in a Wagner opera. He's playing the thieving troll Alberich in Das Rheingold at the Met. The new high-tech production is directed by Robert Lepage, whose credits run from nine-hour theatrical marathons to Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas.
Of course, his voice is amazing, but he's also a good actor. He's a good character actor. And this is a bit of a counter-role in the sense that he's probably the most sympathetic human being in this universe, and he gets to play this very pathetic, not very sympathetic character. And he actually really dives into it.
And this is the kind of production where, when singers dive into it, they really dive. It's very physically demanding. Eric Owen says he's been enjoying not just the musical, but the cardiovascular challenges of the role, even if he admits he's a little overwhelmed to be part of opening night at the Met.
You know, I have to make sure I can stay focused and not have one of these, oh my goodness gracious moments of, you know, wow, look at me, I'm up here with all these amazing people doing this amazing music and this amazing theater.
Eric Owens opens in Das Rheingold tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.